Some warn I'm headed from nowhere to nowhere. Others insist I'm all it takes to make nowhere somewhere. I'm a track, a line, the oldest way of marking yours and mine, or making yours mine.
Who is this?
Sioki Mao the seer said, the pale people will come on an iron snake. Its tail will lie in the ocean, its head in a great central lake. I am that creature, contested, resented, expected long before I arrived. Time will tell whether I connect or divide. Thus spoke the track that was started by the British colonizers in 1896 from the port city of Mombasa on the Indian Ocean, and continued to be constructed over 5 years and more than 1,000 kilometers to the eastern shore of Lake Victoria. It was known as the Uganda Railway. I first saw it as a child in the 1980s. It seemed like a discarded fish skeleton. I would have struggled to believe, even if I'd known my history, which I didn't, that this spindly single track had been a transformative thoroughfare, coercing the land through which it passed into the shape of a state called Kenya. Around 30,000 Indians, so-called coolies, were brought over by the British to build the track. Some had been involved in constructing the vast network that had railroaded their own land into colonial compliance. Most were unskilled laborers, considered to be more reliable and hardworking than the locals, who, for reasons the British found hard to comprehend, wouldn't always obediently cooperate in fettering their homeland for foreigners. Slat by slat, metal ribs are laid to ground. Plate by plate, a spinal cord is unwound. Hard as nails, iron-bound, I push through savannah, sleeper by sleeper. Screwed down with spikes, I move deeper and deeper into the heart of nowhere, closing the gap between here and there. The land the track would cut through, then designated as British East Africa Protectorate, was considered useless, just a region of bush the colonists needed to penetrate so that their claim on the area could be entrenched and resources from Uganda more easily exploited. What's the sound of your track?
Although I, or we, I'm not sure which would be more appropriate, was familiar with this language, having heard humans make use of it, I have never used it as such. So I ask you to bear with me as I acclimate, just as you did, to this unique form at. Why are we destined to use another's language to communicate? Did we, you and I, once have a mother tongue that was severed and silenced by history? And now we have to translate and translocate ourselves and others across geographies of meaning and intelligibility? I am obsessed with my, your, our painful prehistory. Is there such a thing? What were we before we became the ribs of an empire? I will tell you my story, and I want to hear more of yours.
Elementally, we're not so different, you and me. The red of your blood is the gray of my bone, for iron is the essence from which all is grown. Ore, mind, melted and mutated through the magic of metallurgy. This is my genealogy. Easy enough to trace, though hardly free from the complex strains of gender, creed, and race. Born of the earth, built by men, I am something in between, neither natural nor machine. I borrow from all, and the ensuing reaction makes a sound you might call traction, a language punctuated by the grammar of moving metal, a loud, echoing, aching, hoping rattle. The idea of the Uganda Railway was conjured in English clubrooms filled with cigar smoke and callous confidence. though not with complete consensus. Some feared the project was too costly and risky. Those in support tried to win over the doubters with a humanitarian argument. A railway would help stamp out the last vestiges of the slave trade in East Africa. Surely no one could object to such a noble goal. In case the suppression of slavery was not adequate incentive, those in favor of the railway also emphasized the risk of other colonial powers, like France and Germany, making gains in East Africa. Retaining British influence over the Nile was critical, for to master the Nile was to rule Egypt, which was to hold the Suez Canal, which was to own a vital gateway between Europe and the world. Therefore, a track had to be built to secure access to the stretch of the Nile in Uganda. Africa is the last frontier of capitalism, the Cameroonian philosopher Achille Mbembe has often said. It is the last territory on earth that has not yet been entirely subjected to the rule of capital.
No, we're not so different. I, too, was mined and melted when that precious black gold was discovered, sleeping in the bowels of this earth. Imperial desires dictated that it be awakened and summoned to the surface to serve and flow. I and many of my kind were born of collusions and concessions across continents, meant to redraw geopolitical maps, to expand and to extend power. I was placed here, somewhere between Baghdad and Samarra, rather late in the game. I relate what I have heard from those who put me here, from neighbors and elders, from travelers too, who think that having no ears we can't hear. I have heard and seen too much. Officially, I am a vertebra in the Berlin-Baghdad railway, but my lineage in pre-life goes through other cities. By 1888, Berlin was linked to Constantinople through the extension of the Oriental Railway. 8 years later, the Anatolian Railway Company, a syndicate dominated by Deutsche Bank, finished extending the line to Konya. 1903 in the calendar of humans is an important date for me. The Baghdad Railway Company, also dominated by Deutsche Bank, was formed to extend the line to Baghdad. But I was not to be until 1917. I was born in times of war. Names and titles are often misleading. Berlin to Baghdad. Deutsche Bank invested in linking the banks of the Spree with the banks of the Tigris. But the ultimate goal was Basra, access to and a port on the warm waters of the Gulf. You wrote of the rule of capital in your last letter. Black gold was, and still is, I hear these days, very tempting and destructive. The concession, what a word. The concession back then included rights of exploration up to 20 kilometers on both sides of the track. Ah, well.
Ah, not so well, I'm inclined to say. Local land rights here were disregarded in a similar way. Any area within a mile radius of me was automatically declared British Crown property. But by the end, it was clear. The price had been dear. 4 Indians died for every mile of my track. The Brits didn't bother to count any dead who were black. As for the damage to nature, it too doesn't feature. Only profits decide the success of a venture. But far apart as you and I are, our histories are tied. And I think our futures too will be strangely allied. Mark my rails. Our tracks are destined to connect, thanks to China's Belt and Road project. A fresh incarnation of the ancient Silk Route, it heralds a new era of imperial pursuit. This time I've heard countries join in by choice. This time they are partners with cause to rejoice. So if not you and I, then our sibling lines may join the world over thanks to Chinese designs. Since the year 2000, the Chinese have extended about $100 billion worth of loans to Africa. Around a quarter of the credit Beijing gives to Africa is for rail and road projects. New tracks have been or are in the process of being laid all over the continent, including between Abuja and Kaduna in Nigeria, along the Nile in Sudan, from Tanzania to Zambia, from Ethiopia to Djibouti. In some places, the new lines snake right alongside the old colonial ones. Construction on a brand new second track running parallel to and beyond the old Uganda Railway began in 2015. Financed predominantly by the Chinese and built under their supervision, the first stretch of Kenya's standard gauge railway was completed earlier this year. Since 2015, Kenya has become the top recipient of Chinese funds. As in other African countries, at least 80% of the money for the new standard gauge railway has been loaned by Beijing. Kenya's external debt now amounts to 7 times its annual budget, with nearly 60% of its loans coming from China. China's Belt and Road Initiative aims to connect the country with the rest of Asia, with Africa and Europe, through an elaborate set of overland and maritime transport corridors across various territories, including Pakistan and Afghanistan, the eastern and southern Mediterranean, and the Indian Ocean. It is set to involve more than 60 countries, which together represent a third of the world's total economy and more than half of the global population. In May 2017, at a summit arranged to win support for the plan, China pledged to invest $125 billion in this project of the century, which it claims will add splendor to human civilization and is not a chance to assert a new hegemony, but an opportunity to bring an old one to an end. The Kenyan government claims the infrastructure will help to realize Agenda 2063, the African Union's vision for an integrated, united, peaceful, sovereign, independent, confident, and self-reliant continent of seamless borders. Their aspiration is also that by 2020, all remnants of colonialism will have ended. How often can colonialism end? Surely kowtowing to China could not have been what Frantz Fanon meant when he concluded in The Wretched of the Earth, "The European game has finally ended. We must find something different."
I once thought that colonialism had died, but I was wrong. It is chameleon-like. Its ghosts and bodies continue to haunt and hunt this land until today. I thought the British were gone for good, but they returned. As I mentioned before, I came to being just before their soldiers arrived in Mesopotamia. On July 27, 1912, the Baghdad Rail heading north was begun. An august ceremony was held, attended by the then Ottoman Vali of Baghdad, Jamal Pasha. 2 years later, the British occupied Basra in the south and pushed forward, extending their own tracks. By the time they reached Baghdad in March 1917, the Ottomans withdrew north. They passed on me. I felt the weight of their soldiers and weapons. I heard they had torched what they couldn't carry from Baghdad. I saw the black smoke plumes carried by the winds. The British kept pushing forward until they took Mosul and they added more of my siblings and expanded the network. We carry the victors and the vanquished on our backs. In 1929, the administration of the railway was transferred from the British military to a civil administration, still British. It wasn't until 1924 that Iraqis were to administer their railways, but ownership was still British. In 1936, Britain sold Iraqi railways to the Iraqi government for £494,000. The British reoccupied Iraq. They hadn't left, but hid in military bases. They reoccupied Iraq again in 1941, but were forced to leave in 1958 when the monarchy was overthrown. The early Republican years were good for my kind and for the mortals who lived here. But then there were violent coups. In 1980, a devastating war started and lasted longer than World War II. Another war was started in 1991 by the Americans, followed by a brutal embargo. I and my kind suffered a lot during those years. I relate all of this to say how shocked I was when I heard through the track vine that the British had returned yet again in 2003. They stayed in and around Basra, but the Americans, their fellow occupiers, were the colonial masters. Chaos reigned, and there was looting and sabotage. Many of my kind were wrenched away to be smuggled or sold. There were plans and promises of reconstruction, but very little materialized. New borders were drawn in blood, and passage and movement became treacherous. Overnight journeys ran only between Baghdad and Basra. And China has come here too, or at least its trains. In February 2014, 10 new Chinese-made trains were delivered and are now running between Baghdad and Basra. But in June of that year, Mosul, a major city, fell to ISIS. It was liberated a few months ago, but it lies in ruins, and it will take billions to rebuild. Being where I am, it is difficult for me to imagine connectivity in the near future. Much of this country lies in ruins and is ruled by militias. They prefer pickup trucks to trains. My Syrian siblings and neighbors would say the same. There was a time when we carried everything and everyone all the way to Palestine and back, but geographies are mutilated.
Mutilated, abbreviated, reconstituted. Borders extend and shrink. Histories shift in a blink. All the while, over the same land, you and I slink. Once, I too was a source of plenty for others. Some stole pieces of me to share with their brothers. Maasai took my bolts and made jewels for celebration. They turned my spikes into decoration. Now I'm rusty, unwanted, hardly fit to ride, and there's a brand new version of me off to one side. The historian Sebastian Conrad suggests that the notion post-colonial is perhaps most productive as a point of departure, a way of thinking about the world, a mode of discourse. He describes post-colonial as a cognitive condition. Let's conceive of it thus, as a mentality, an outlook to be cultivated, an attempt to disentangle oneself, however clumsily, however briefly, from the messy circuitry of colonialism, which has left indelible tracks, not just over the face of our earth, but across the landscapes of our minds. During the construction of the Uganda Railway, it's estimated that 2,500 Indians died and 6,000 were disabled. Most of the survivors returned home after the track was completed, but around 7,000 opted to remain in Kenya. They worked primarily as traders along the track and were soon a vital, thriving part of the local economy. Tales of Indian success reached the homeland and compelled others to go try their luck in Africa. Variam Singh Jandu was one of these. He came by dhow in the early 1920s without a passport or a visa or a trade. He settled beside the railway, almost midway between Mombasa and Lake Victoria, in a spot called Awaso Naiberi, a place of cool waters, which, true to its name, was temperate and pleasant. The colonizers dubbed it Nairobi, and in 1919, it had become the capital of British East Africa. In 1934, Narinder Singh Bansal, a newly qualified young engineer, left India to take up a job maintaining the Uganda Railway. By then, the last section of the line had been completed, and it had finally reached the Ugandan capital, Kampala, where Bansal ended up settling down after several years spent overseeing various sections of the track. He was one of those who thrived because of the railway. Along the route, though, somewhere in the maze of empire, bureaucracy. His surname lost a consonant and swapped a vowel. He became Narinder Singh Basil. One day, Variam Singh's granddaughter would marry Narinder Singh's youngest son. The couple would have a daughter called Priya Basil, who grew up with no idea that a rail track was responsible for her existence and was naively pleased about the herb-scented clerical error which had endowed her family with a name that had such a distinctly British ring to it. Lunatic line, lunatic line, lunatic, lunatic line. That's what British newspapers called me once upon a time. Ah, stray stanzas dazzle me, nettle me, unsettle me. The metal of meter versus the meters of metal, me. What are wordways or railways but different lines, different signs of something on the move? Meanings, memories, materials, different ways to race the fleeting hour, to disprove the claims of power.
Yes, the prefix in the post-colonial marks a beginning and not an end, the beginning of the aftermath. I am not sure how easy it would be to disentangle ourselves from the messiness. The story you relate about Priya Basil is quite fascinating. Humans are as fascinated by us as we are by them. In my hours, or rather days or weeks, of prosaic solitude, I recite what some of them have said about us in poetry. It is never entirely about us, of course, but about them as they go about. It seems that our form and function, I know I am a mere track, but I'm taking the liberty of speaking for the whole, as I have often done. Our form and function crystallize their paradoxical existence and their political plights. They do have plenty of joyful songs of lovers meeting and reuniting and workers and warriors returning home, but I find the poems about separation, departure, and loss more intriguing. At the station of a train which fell off the map. I stood at the station not to wait for the train or for my hidden feelings in the aesthetics of some distant object, but to know how the sea went mad and how the place broke like a porcelain jar. To know when I was born, where I lived, how birds migrated south or north. The train moved like a peaceful snake from Syria to Egypt. Its whistling hid the hoarse bleating of goats from the wolves' voracity, as if it was a mythical time to tame the wolves to befriend us. Its smoke billowed over the fire in the villages, which were blossoming like trees. The train was a wild ship docking and carrying us to the realistic cities of imagination. Whenever we needed some innocent play with destinies, the windows of the train have the status of the magical in the mundane. Everything runs. Trees, thoughts, waves, and towers run behind us. The scent of lemons, the air, and all things run. So does the yearning for an ambiguous distant. The heart runs. I stood at the station. I was abandoned like the time attendant's room in that station. I was a robbed man looking at his coffers and asking himself, was that field mine? Was that treasure mine? Was this lapis lazuli wet with the humidity and night dew mine? Was I one day the butterfly's student in fragility and boldness at times, and her colleague in metaphor at others? Was I once mine? Does memory fall sick with me and have a fever? Like the sound of bells, time was broken right here. I stood when my wound was 60 years old. I stood at the station not to wait for the train or for the cheers of those returning from the south to grain spikes, but to preserve the shore of olives and lemons in the history of my map. Is this all this for absence and for what is left of the crumbs of the unseen for me? Did my ghost pass by and wave from a distance and disappear? Did I ask it, is it that whenever the stranger smiles and greets us, we slaughter a gazelle? You are you even if you lose. You and I are two in the past and one tomorrow. The train passed by and we were not watchful. Get up, intact and optimistic. Do not wait for anyone except you over there. Here the train fell off the map halfway on the coastal road. Fires blazed the heart of the map and then were put out by the late winter. I see my place, all of it around me. I see myself in this place with all my parts and names. I see the palm trees correcting the errors in my classical Arabic. I see the habits of almond blossoms straining my song for a sudden joy. There is no train. No one will wait for the train. Our country is the heart of the map, the heart pierced like a metal coin in the market. The last passenger from somewhere in Syria to Egypt did not return to pay the sniper's fee for his extra work, as the strangers expect. He did not return and did not carry his death and birth certificate with him so that the scholars of resurrection would know his place in paradise. We were such angels and fools when we believed the banners and horses and believed that an eagle's wing will lift us above. The train fell off the map, and you were burned by the past's ember. Thank you.
The tracks meet.